every eye in the room upon him. Many of his fellow cadets were squirming, well aware that there but for the grace of God they might be.
"No, sir," Matthews responded. "But I have identified a suspect, sir."
Grant shared a sadist smile with the others in the room.
"Oh, yeah?" he said. "And who might that be?"
"It's you, sir," Matthews responded.
There was a momentary silence, then a murmur swept the room. The sergeant's face contorted.
"Me? What the fuck are you talking about?"
"I went to Major Sandstrom's office during our lunch hour, sir. He told me he hadn't received any call from you regarding any missing pistol. He didn't have any idea what I was talking about."
"Are you calling me a liar?"
Grant said, rising from his seat.
"I'd like permission to interview you, sir. You've been instructing us on interviewing suspects, and I think you took my pistol to teach me a lesson. I'd like to ask if you or anyone at your direction might have gone to the locker room this morning and removed my pistol from my locker."
By this point, the sergeant's face was an apoplectic mask.
"Shut the fuck up and sit down, Matthews," he said.
If he had harbored any suspicion that all of this had been something of a training exercise, the spittle flying from Grant's lips convinced Matthews otherwise. Sometimes discretion was the better part of valor, he decided. On the way out of the room after class was dismissed, one of his fellow cadets gave him a consoling pat on the shoulder.
"You've done it this time, Matthews," he said.
"You're out of here for sure."
Matthews shrugged.
"Maybe you're right," he said. "But I do know one thing. That bastard took my gun."
His fellow cadet could only shake his head, and the two hurried off to class. Later that afternoon, Matthews returned to open his locker. Sure enough, his pistol had been replaced. It is one of many stories reflecting Matthews's refusal to be cowed by blowhards, but it is surely not the only one. Shortly after he'd graduated from the academy and joined the ranks of beat cops at Miami Beach PD, Matthews turned up at morning roll call to hear a pronouncement. There had been too many complaints from high rollers in big cars and the owners of delivery companies with drivers trying to navigate the clogged streets of the densely populated island. Every officer was to make the ticketing of double-parked cars a priority. Not a problem, Matthews thought, and set out upon his rounds for the day. He had scarcely turned the corner of Lincoln Road onto Alton when he saw a big Buick pull up beside a car parked in front of Alfie's, a mega-sized Miami version of a New York City candy store come newsstand. The driver got out of the Buick, gave Matthews an uninterested glance, and then strolled casually into the store. It might have been a brazen enough action, parking your barge of a sedan in a busy traffic lane while a cop approached, but on top of everything else, there were empty parking places both in front of and behind the car the guy had parked beside. Matthews shook his head and made his own way into the store. There he found the guy from the sedan at the counter, engaged in earnest conversation with the owner.
"Excuse me, sir," Matthews called. "You're double parked outside. You'll have to move your car."
The guy kept on talking, ignoring him. Matthews joined him at the counter, holding up his ticket book.
"You're double parked," he repeated.
"If you don't move, I'll have to write you a ticket." Alfie, the proprietor, gave Matthews a doubtful look from behind the counter, but said nothing. The guy at the counter turned, gave Matthews a snicker, then turned back and resumed his conversation with Alfie.
"Okay by me," Matthews said. "I'll be outside writing tickets," he went on, "and I'll still be writing them until you come out there and move your car."
He left the store and walked to the back of the car to check the plate number. Having never issued a citation for double parking, he had to consult his statute book to find the proper code, and that took him a few moments. He had completed that citation and was at work on a second, for obstructing traffic, when the door to Alfie's finally opened and the guy came out, a look of disbelief on his face.
"What do you think you're doing?" the guy said.
"Exactly what I told you I'd be doing," Matthews said.
He finished the second citation and tore a copy out of his book. He thrust the two tickets at the guy, who rolled his eyes and brushed past him.
As the guy got into his car and slammed the door, Matthews approached, lifted the wiper on the driver's side of the windshield, and snapped the two tickets under the rubber blade. The driver's side window rolled down, and the guy thrust his face through the opening. "You don't know who you're screwing with, do you?" he demanded. By this point, Matthews had had enough. He bent close enough to smell the guy's boozer breath. "You don't know who you're screwing with, do you?" The guy's eyes widened in surprise momentarily. "Fuck you," he said finally, then floored the Buick's accelerator and sped away. "Fuck you," Matthews called after him. He noted that Alfie had come out onto the sidewalk to witness the scene. The proprietor gave Matthews a baleful look, then went back inside. Matthews shrugged and went on about his day. Before dismissal at the following morning's roll call, the patrol sergeant reiterated the need for them all to be vigilant about ticketing double parkers, and then, as everyone was filing out, called Matthews to his desk. "Captain Webb wants to see you," the sergeant said. When Matthews asked the sergeant if he knew what it was about, the sergeant gave him a look. "I think I'll let the captain explain. Just get your ass down there." Accordingly, Matthews made his way to the patrol commander's office. As Matthews stood nervously at attention, Webb gave him the once-over, then tented his fingers, and finally began. "Since when did you start issuing parking tickets to police officers?" Webb inquired. Matthews was genuinely perplexed. "I don't know what you mean, sir. I wouldn't do anything like that." "Then why did you write Captain Henry Dworkin, who happens to be commander of the Detective Bureau, two parking tickets yesterday, one for double parking and another for obstructing traffic?" Matthews stared at the tickets Captain Webb had produced, a feeling of dread washing over him. "Ah, I had no idea he was a police officer, sir." His supervisor stared at him. "Well, you made one hell of a mistake, Matthews." "Yes, sir," Matthews said. "And you need to take care of these tickets," his supervisor added. Matthews nodded. "I'll do that, sir." "Good," his supervisor said, giving him a weary look. "Go to it. And try to keep your head out of your ass from now on, will you?" By the time he made his way down the hallway from the squad room, Matthews's shock had abated, and resentment had begun to take its place. Why hadn't Dworkin just said he was a cop in the first place? Why be such a dick about it? Anyway, he thought, his supervisor had told him to take care of the matter, and so he would. He'd go right to Captain Dworkin's office and do whatever it took. At his knock on Dworkin's door, a voice issued, inviting him in. Matthews entered to find the guy he'd given the tickets sitting behind a desk. "What are you doing here?" Dworkin said, the instant he saw who it was. "I just wanted to talk to you about those tickets," Matthews began. Dworkin stared as if a leper was about to climb into his lap. "Get the fuck out of my office and don't you ever come back," he said. "Yes, sir," Matthews said, and turned on his heel. As he was making his way down the hallway in the aftermath, he heard a voice calling after him. "Hey, Matthews!" "What now?" he thought, as he turned to see Detective Walter Philbin stepping out of a doorway, beckoning toward him. Philbin was a lieutenant of detectives, a tall, muscular guy with plenty of swagger and the look of a ladies' man. He was a big drinker and a high-stakes gambler, but he had connections inside the department and on the streets as well. His was a legendary presence in the department's detective bureau. "I just wanted to say you got some balls, kid. Telling Dworkin he doesn't know who he's fucking with, that's classic." Philbin laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. Matthews stared back in some concern. "How'd you hear about that?" He glanced down the hall toward the office he'd just left. "Did Dworkin tell you?" "Hell no," Philbin said, waving his hand. "The guy's a total asshole. Nobody talks to him. Alfie told me what happened. He said he never saw anything like it." Philbin was about to duck back into his office, then stopped. "By the way, go see Esther down in the traffic division. She'll tell you how to make those tickets go away." It might have been the end of the matter, and just one more story about Joe Matthews and how his penchant for doing the right thing always seemed to land him in trouble, except for one thing. It was not long after that encounter that Chief Pomerantz asked Walter Philbin to put together a task force that would do whatever was necessary to bring down the crime rate on Miami Beach. Pomerantz and Philbin were in agreement as to the kind of officers needed for such an assignment. There'd be some ticklish situations dealing with hardened criminals who'd prefer to take their chances on justice in a shootout as opposed to a courtroom, and you'd need to be able to trust your partners to stand up during and after tough situations like those. Accordingly, Philbin primarily chose men whom he'd known for years, experienced and able cops, those savvy enough to understand when justice had to be dispensed with on the spot and how to keep their mouths shut afterward. Given his dictum that you couldn't trust a man you couldn't drink with, Philbin would probably have added incipient alcoholism to his list of qualifications as well. But there was rigor in such work, and the need for a certain amount of young blood, too. It was in that way, then, that Joe Matthews found himself plucked from the ranks of the beat cops to become part of a task force that one day would be dispatched to a stakeout at the Shoreham Hotel, and from there to any number of other incidents that would propel him upward through the ranks. From task force to detective bureau to sergeant, from homicide investigator to polygraph expert to Dade County Cop of the Year, and ultimately to involvement with the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh. Flap, flap, flap. Hollywood, Florida, August 16, 1994. Despite his reservations about the motives of Joe Matthews, Detective Smith proceeded with his work on the Adam Walsh case, albeit at a deliberate pace. He met with Harry O'Reilly, the retired NYPD homicide detective who had put the department back in touch with Matthews, and Smith and O'Reilly traveled to the spot off Florida's turnpike where Toole originally said he'd disposed of Adam's head and body to determine whether or not O'Reilly thought it might be worth conducting a second concerted search for remains. O'Reilly doubted that there was anything to be accomplished by such an undertaking, but he did return from the trip with a real concern. He called Joe Matthews to tell him about the foray, wondering why Smith had not asked Matthews to join them, a point at which Matthews realized that whatever might eventuate from his collaboration with Smith, the two were certainly not functioning as true partners. Not until the following January did Smith take his next significant step, telephoning John Walsh to seek approval to get a DNA baseline sample using Adam's mandible as a source. A few days later, Smith wrote a memo to his superiors indicating that it had been suggested that he send hair samples from the victim, along with the bloody machete and bloodstained sheath, and a sample of the carpet taken from the Cadillac for DNA comparison testing. Smith then called the FDLE, looking for the carpet samples that they had tested a dozen years before. But those had been sent back to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office long ago, Smith was told. And accordingly, on January 17, 1995, he drove to Jacksonville to search the sheriff's evidence room for the carpet samples and try and discover the whereabouts of the vehicle itself. What he discovered was disheartening, to say the least. Records showed that the Cadillac's floorboard carpets and the seven squares tested for blood had been received by the sheriff's property room on May 24, 1984, signed for with the initial J. Whether the J stood for Jack Hoffman or Jacksonville, no one could say. Whatever had happened to the carpet samples once they arrived at the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, only one thing was certain. 11 years later, they were nowhere to be found. As for the car itself, Smith learned, it was sold to a dealer at auction, purchased by a man from St. Augustine, then, when it finally stopped running a half dozen years or more before, towed to a junkyard and scrapped. Smith, distressed at such sloppy handling of key evidence in the case, filed a complaint with the FDLE, but it went nowhere. As for the machete and its sheath, those items remained in the possession of the Hollywood PD, and Smith forwarded them for testing. Once again, the results were not what he or Matthews hoped for. Though testing on those items performed by FDLE serologist James Pollock in 1983 had confirmed the presence of small amounts of blood, the laboratory to which they were sent for DNA testing in 1995 could find no blood anywhere. As a result of that, no additional comparisons were made, the technician advised. While that scarcely qualified as good news, Matthews moved forward. Following 10 months of effort, he was finally able to arrange an interview with Otis Toole, scheduled for June 20, 1995. Though by this time Toole had adopted a newly stated policy that he would not grant any interviews to law enforcement officials investigating specific homicides, Matthews was able to convince him to make something of an exception. Matthews had arranged for Toole's prison counselor to identify him in his role as a clinical research associate from Nova Southeastern University and a police detective from Miami Beach, not Hollywood, all of which was true. Toole was told that he was simply one of many convicted murderers to be interviewed by Matthews, who was conducting a study of the phenomenon of serial killing. After some consideration, Toole agreed to talk, and the interview was set to be conducted in the prison library without the use of handcuffs or restraints, so that it might seem more like a bit of academic inquiry than an interrogation. Though it had taken some time, Matthews was champing at the bit. After years of frustration, he would finally have the chance to fix the lens of reason upon the only viable suspect in the murder of Adam Walsh. On Father's Day, Sunday, June 18th, 2 days before the interview was scheduled, Matthews called Detective Smith to make sure all was in order for the trip to Stark. There was an awkward pause when Smith realized who was on the other end of the line. "Hasn't anyone called you?" he asked Matthews. "About what?" Matthews asked, wary. "Well," Smith fumbled, "actually, Chief Witt wants me to take this Juvenile Division Detective Navarro along to conduct the interview instead of you." To Matthews, it seemed as if he were reliving a familiar nightmare. "You can't be serious," he told Smith. "Look, Joe," said Smith, "I'm sorry. This was not my call. I hope you know that." Matthews knew nothing, really, except that it had to be some giant mistake. Chief Witt had gone to Matthews' own superiors to negotiate an interagency agreement. Hollywood PD had come to him, not the other way around. Since it was Sunday, however, there was no way to contact Witt, and Matthews could only stew until Monday morning, when he called the chief, hoping to clear up the misunderstanding. When the two finally spoke, Witt quickly explained that there was nothing to explain. He thanked Sergeant Matthews for all his help and was grateful to Miami Beach PD for making him available, but, said Witt, for reasons having to do with any possible future court proceedings, he wanted Toole's confession obtained by his own personnel. Matthews could not believe what he was hearing. So now Hollywood PD believed that Toole was guilty, but they wanted to make sure they got all the credit for making the case? He reminded Chief Witt that he had asked for Matthews' assistance, and that Matthews had been working alongside Detective Smith for more than a year, preparing for the opportunity to interview Toole at last. "How about this?" Matthews suggested. "I'll conduct the interview, and even if we get a confession out of Toole, you won't have to include me in the report. Just use the names of your guys, Smith and Navarro, whoever you want." Witt allowed that Matthews was being very generous, but he had made his decision. His own men would conduct the interview with Toole, and that was the long and short of it. By this time, Matthews was ready to lose it. "Just tell me the truth, Dick. What the fuck is really going on over there?" he blurted. There was a moment of silence on the other end, and then Witt hung up. Matthews sat back in his chair, literally sick at what had transpired. He'd been jerked around before, plenty of times, but never like this. A long time ago, he'd become resigned to the fact that Jack Hoffman wanted no part of his involvement in the investigation, but he could chalk that up to one individual's insecurities, no matter how frustrating and tragic the consequences. But now the chief of the department was chasing Matthews off the case. And for what earthly reason? Was it because they really thought Toole was guilty and wanted all the credit for themselves? Or was there a darker explanation, he wondered? Could it possibly be that the last thing Hollywood PD wanted was to find that Otis Toole had been guilty all along? "Hey, the kid's been dead 15 years. His old man's a celebrity now. The guy who claims he did it is locked up for life. Why try to fix what isn't really broken and make yourself look bad in the process?
Matthews shook his head at the very thought.
Matthews would never be able to answer his questions with certainty, but certain things that happened in the lee of his dismissal from the case for a third time have their implications. Late in the afternoon of the same day he spoke with Chief Witt, Matthews returned to the offices of the homicide unit, intending to pick up where he'd left off the day before on a troubling matter that had nothing to do with the Adam Walsh case. A female police officer had filed a lawsuit against the police department for allowing a hostile work environment, and as a result of that lawsuit, had been transferred from Uniform Patrol to the Detective Bureau. Soon after her arrival, she'd complained that her new fellow officers were playing demeaning pranks and tampering with the personal effects on her desk while she was out of the office, spilling coffee on her favorite pink desk pads, placing her animal statuettes in coital positions and the like. To Matthews, it seemed pretty trivial stuff on both sides, and he scarcely paid any attention to it. But then, after being called in to investigate a homicide during the early morning hours on Sunday, Matthews had returned to his office and was leaning back in his chair, trying to clarify what needed to be done regarding the crime scene he'd just left. It was then that he noticed something odd about one of the ceiling panels next to the air conditioning vent directly overhead. He asked one of his junior detectives to place a chair on his desk and check it out. The kid, who'd worked for the CIA out of college, took a look behind the AC grate and told Matthews he'd found a video surveillance camera there, trained on the complaining officer's desk, but encompassing the entire room. Matthews notified his immediate supervisor and called in the department's crime techs to remove and process the camera. Though he could not be certain, the fact that the camera bore the logo of a private security firm suggested that the transferred female officer had taken it upon herself to try and collect evidence against those moving her statues around and writing derisive notes on her desk blotter. Whoever was responsible for hiding this camera, though, and whatever the reason, Matthews wanted the matter settled. They were a crimes against persons squad, with all sorts of sensitive information being discussed in that room. You couldn't have someone recording what went on there willy-nilly, no matter how many times you found your turtle statuettes humping each other. At least getting to the bottom of who had put that camera up there would take his mind off the fiasco with the aborted Otis Toole interview, he thought. But such thoughts didn't last long. He hadn't even sat down in his chair that Monday afternoon when he noticed a memo placed prominently on his desk. Something to do with the camera investigation already, he wondered. He picked up the sheet and began to read it, disbelief filling him as he digested the words. It was a notice from Patricia Schneider, the major in charge of the Detective Bureau. Effective immediately, a few months shy of his retirement date after 29 years with the department, Matthews was being transferred back to uniform patrol duty. Matthews couldn't believe his eyes. When he went into the office of his commanding officer for an explanation, she shrugged. It was within her power to transfer at will. She didn't have to explain anything to him. But no one got transferred without cause, Matthews protested, the sick feeling in his stomach now an icy cannonball. Only if you screwed up big time, or couldn't get along with your superiors. It was the unwritten rule within any department. What was going on here? Everyone knew Matthews was the go-to investigator in the department, and he was the supervisor of the Crimes Against Persons Unit, and he got along fine with those above and below him. She knew that. The major shrugged. She wasn't so sure. She had heard he couldn't get along very well with Dick Witt over at Hollywood PD. Matthews was stunned. Less than 6 hours since he'd spoken with Witt, and already he was being torpedoed? He left the major's office without another word and made his way to the office of the chief. Matthews had known Richard Barreto for a long time, and while they weren't necessarily pals, they got along just fine. Matthews showed Barreto the memo from his supervisor, and Barreto handed it back to him. "So?" he asked Matthews. "So?" Matthews repeated. "What the hell is going on here? Is Dick Witt the chief of this department, or are you? I just talked with the major. She let the cat out of the bag. I give Dick Witt a little grief, and suddenly I'm being transferred back into uniform?" Barreto stared evenly back at Matthews.
Dick Witt doesn't have anything to do with your transfer. You interfered with a sexual harassment investigation being conducted by our Internal Affairs Division. That's why you're being transferred.
Matthews shook his head in puzzlement.
What the hell are you talking about?
That camera you had removed from the office was placed there by IA.
Matthews was dumbfounded by Barreto's revelation.
It was a departmental surveillance camera?
You mean Internal Affairs took all that turtle statue shit seriously? That's still no reason for me to be transferred.
Barreto folded his hands and leaned across his desk.
I'm the acting chief, he told Matthews, and I would like to become the chief. The major wants you transferred, and I can't undermine my command staff by issuing counterorders. It's as simple as that.
Matthews started to protest yet again, but what was the point? He'd simply done what any other detective who'd found a spy camera in his office would have done. All that was just a smokescreen.
He stood up and walked out of Barreto's office while the acting chief was prattling on, reminding him that he had just a few months left to retirement and that he probably had that much leave time accrued. Matthews could, in effect, retire right now. No worries about uniform duty.
Sure, Matthews was thinking.
But all he could think about was what had happened to Buddy Terry in Jacksonville. Terry was a well-respected, hard-working detective who had gotten crosswise with Hollywood PD trying to make headway on the Adam Walsh case, and look what had happened to him. Now, and Matthews was certain of it, he had made the same mistake.
When he came home that evening, Ginny met him at the door, excited, waving a sheaf of photos. Joe had missed the opening of Christina's dance recital the day before because he'd been held up at work, but that was no problem. She had these great pictures of their daughter coming out on stage. When she suddenly saw the expression on Joe's face, she stopped. She took a closer look at what was in the box. Pictures from his office, a dozen years of the kids growing up, one of his father, who'd been so proud of his detective son, and framed commendations. When she heard Joe's account, she was stunned. That's the thanks he got for caring about a case an entire police department had botched? Finally, she took a deep breath and said, "Joe, things happen for a reason. Your family loves you. I love you. It's going to be fine." When his brother Pete, also a Miami Beach detective sergeant and supervisor of the department's Crimes Against Property Unit, heard what had happened, he demanded a transfer back to uniform patrol as well.
"You don't need to do that," Matthews protested to his brother, but Pete was having none of it. It was all bullshit, and everyone knew it.
Sure enough, when Matthews turned up at roll call on his first day back in uniform, the entire shift stood to give him a lengthy ovation. They all knew it wasn't much, but it was the very least they could do. Rayford, Florida, June 27, 1995. On Tuesday of the following week, Detective Smith did in fact travel to Rayford, Florida with Detective Navarro, where they sought to interview Otis Toole at the Union Correctional Institution. "Toole had no initial response to the introduction," wrote Smith in his report, "until he was informed of the purpose of the interview. Once he realized that the two were there to question him in regard to his involvement in the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh, Toole became disturbed," Smith said, "and stated that he had no involvement in this case or any other cases, including the ones of which he was convicted." Adam Walsh's 21st birthday passed later that year, and then, less than a month later, on Tuesday, December 5th, convicted serial killer Gerald Schaefer, former cellmate and erstwhile legal advisor of Otis Toole, was found dead in his cell at Stark, stabbed several times in the eye, his throat slit. In an interview with the Palm Beach Post, Schaefer's mother and sister said to reporters that he had told them that he was about to cooperate with detectives on the Adam Walsh case. He had agreed to testify in an upcoming proceeding, he confided to them, and explained that he hoped to gain early parole as a result. That explained why he'd been killed, the women told reporters. If the bits and pieces of the case against Otis Toole already seemed to be dissolving, what happened in early 1996 appeared to be the death knell for the matter altogether. In early May 1995, the Mobile Press Register had filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act asking that the contents of the Hollywood Police Department file on Adam Walsh be made public. As often happens in any missing child case, there had always been a certain amount of innuendo involving the parents. There was the scandal involving Revay's short-lived affair with Jimmy Campbell, and the bizarre suggestion made by Hoffman's partner Hickman that God would bring Adam back if Walsh would only repent for his misdeeds. Also, as armchair theorists warmed to their work over the long history of the failed investigation, the notion was kicked around that John Walsh had become involved with the mob as a result of his work with an international hotel chain. He'd either screwed up some drug deal, or more charitably refused to partake in one, and the killing of Adam was payback. The real reason that the case had failed to progress, such thinking went, was that Walsh had himself obstructed the investigation and pressured the Hollywood police to drag their feet. Conspiracy theorists everywhere were licking their chops at having the case files laid bare. All the dirt could finally be revealed. And what ace reporter would not dream of being the hero who finally revealed what police couldn't or wouldn't prove in this case of cases? In any event, and whatever they hoped to discover as a result, three other newspapers, the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel, the Palm Beach Post, and the Miami Herald, joined the Mobile Press Register in its suit. Walsh was dismayed at the prospect, for he knew what opening police files would mean to any serious ongoing investigation. Accordingly, he went directly to Chief Witt to press for assurances that the department would fight the request. Meantime, Walsh suggested, during a May 15th meeting at which Joe Matthews and Mark Smith were present, that perhaps Witt could issue a statement that suggested how ridiculous the rumors were that tied him to the mafia. Witt seemed a bit befuddled at the request, however. As Joe Matthews and Walsh stared expectantly at Witt, the chief answered by saying that, in his opinion, anyone who frequented a certain well-known Fort Lauderdale restaurant for lunch, as Walsh did, must have something to do with the mafia. With friends like Dick Witt, Matthews told Walsh on the way out the door, you don't need any enemies. And then in December, the Walshes received more disturbing news from Hollywood police when Mark Smith called to check on something. John Walsh listened patiently to a rambling preamble before finally asking the detective to get to the point. Well, Smith said, they did show you these green shorts and that sandal they found back in 1984, didn't they? Walsh assured Smith that he had no idea what he was talking about, and Smith finally explained. An FDLE team had dug up the items on Otis Toole's property in Jacksonville, Smith told him. The shorts and a child's yellow flip-flop had been sent to Hollywood PD, where they'd been in the evidence room ever since. Walsh, as might be expected, went ballistic at the news. The missing posters that were issued in the wake of Adam's disappearance had described him as wearing green shorts and yellow flip-flops. Now Smith was saying that the detective in charge of the case had discovered such items on the property of the only serious suspect who had ever been identified and had not called him in to see if they belonged to Adam? How could such behavior be explained? Smith obviously could not explain it, but he did arrange a meeting at which the Walshes could view the items. It took nearly a month, but finally, on January 16, 1996, John and Revay Walsh met with Detective Smith and Chief Witt in a conference room at Hollywood PD. Chief Witt began the meeting with a long-winded preamble in which he proclaimed the untiring efforts of his department to solve the case. No effort had been spared, the chief said. No tip had been ignored. Finally, he paused, holding up a large evidence envelope, and gave Revay a glance meant to be solicitous. "Would you and John like to take a minute?" he asked. Revay stared back, dumbfounded. Good Lord, she thought. They'd already been kept waiting for 15 years. "Just show us what you've got," John said. Witt seemed taken aback by Walsh's tone, but he broke off to open up the envelope with a flourish. Revay took one look at the muddy shorts and the tiny shoe that was barely bigger than one an infant might wear and shook her head quickly. No way had these items come from Adam. "They're not his," she told John. The collective disappointment in the room was palpable. Once again, it seemed, Otis Toole had slipped from a snare. Despite the letdown, Detective Smith did his best to put a positive spin on matters for the Walshes. He and Sergeant Matthews had made very real progress on the cold case investigation, he insisted. He mentioned the fact that Sears security guard, Kathy Schaffer, had finally admitted sending Adam outside the store through the door where Toole claimed he'd picked the child up. And he also pointed to the significance of the fact that when Toole made his first confession, no news report had mentioned the site near mile marker 126 where Toole later took detectives. As further corroboration that he knew details that had never been reported in the press, Toole had spoken several times of driving no more than 10 minutes farther north on the turnpike before disposing of the head in the canal. As Smith pointed out, the spot where fishermen had discovered the remains was 4 miles north at mile marker 130. 10 minutes was just how long it would take to turn around on that deserted service road, make your way back to the turnpike, and drive to the spot where Adam's head had been found. Smith then turned his attention to Witt. All these details that Toole had dropped into his multiple confessions were unknown to anyone outside the circle of law enforcement. If they were divulged publicly, however, that evidence would become readily available to any deranged soul who wanted to claim responsibility for the crime. Anyone could say, actually, it was me who pulled off there at mile marker 130 and tossed that head in the canal. Surely, Smith said, Witt understood the importance of standing up against the request to open the files. Witt nodded, tenting his fingers thoughtfully. I suppose you could look at it that way, he said. But I think it is just as likely that opening up the case files would put pressure on Toole to break down and confess. Though no one in the room had the temerity to point out that Toole had already broken down and confessed on several occasions, one thing seemed clear. Even though no ruling on the matter had been issued, Witt had already decided to release the files. As the meeting was winding down, in fact, Witt made the offhanded remark that he already had aides working to transfer the materials onto microfilm, all 10,000 pages of it. In the aftermath of this disclosure, an angry Walsh went immediately to Michael Satz, head of the Broward County State Attorney's Office, to plead that Satz intervene. If the state attorney announced imminent plans to bring a suspect to trial, then it would be a good bet no judge would allow potential evidence to be revealed in public. Walsh begged Satz to review the case file and asked for an explanation why no one in all this time had been willing to prosecute a case against Otis Toole. What Satz had to say in response floored Walsh. There was a simple reason why the case had not gone forward, Satz said. Since the day in 1983, when Chief Martin of the Hollywood Police Department had announced that Otis Toole was their prime suspect in the case, not a shred of evidence had been presented to Satz's office. In fact, the HPD hadn't shared its full case file on the investigation until just 5 days ago, Satz said. Walsh shook his head in disbelief. And what did Satz think about the extortion letter in that file, the one that Toole had sent to him offering to lead Walsh to where Adam's body had been buried for $50,000? Satz had no idea what Walsh was referring to. There was no such letter in the file that had recently been presented to him. When Walsh showed Satz the letter that described his son as crying for his mother as Toole had sodomized him, the state attorney was stunned. He set the letter aside and stood to apologize to Walsh. Of course, his office had been insistent that Hoffman and his team present evidence linking Toole to the crime back in the 1980s, but what he had just read was all a competent attorney needed, Satz said. I could get a jury conviction on the strength of this letter alone, he told Walsh. Furthermore, he said, his office would intervene immediately to prevent the opening of the case files to the media on the grounds that a prosecution against Otis Toole was now imminent and that opening the evidence to the public would compromise the prosecution's ability to prove its case against Toole. On February 16, 1996, a hearing was set on the matter with Revay Walsh present to add a personal plea. But Judge Moe would not allow her to speak. He wanted no appeals to emotion in his court, he explained. And then, after listening to brief presentations by both sides, he issued his order. The case file would be released. with every detail known to investigators, including all crime scene photos, now a part of the public record, the possibility of ever corroborating any future confession against matters known only to police ended. Yet whatever hopes the media might have had as to their own analysis of the case files, they came to very little. There was no hidden evidence concerning John Walsh's ties to the mafia, nor was there any suggestion that he had meddled with the investigation of the Hollywood police in any way, though the spectacular lack of progress might well have warranted it. There was a brief flurry of indignation when reporters realized that key evidence, the bloody carpet samples taken from Toole's Cadillac, as well as the car itself, had been lost. As to that matter, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office was quick to deflect responsibility onto the Hollywood PD. No evidentiary hold had been placed upon the car by the principal investigators, the Sheriff's Office said, so they were only following proper procedure in returning the car to its owner, Wells Brothers Used Cars. As far as the carpet samples were concerned, the sheriff admitted having destroyed them, but again, that was normal procedure for dealing with what were reclassified as non-evidentiary materials. Since the original testing was inconclusive, no one had seen any point in keeping them. As to what had become of the sections of the floor carpets that had not been tested, no one could be sure. Perhaps only the mysterious Jay who signed for them could say. Whatever the validity of the various claims and counterclaims of the agencies involved, anyone who read the various accounts published in the wake of the release of the case files could be forgiven for assuming that the matter was finished. Propriety and impropriety of procedures aside, it simply looked as if police would never find out who had kidnapped and murdered Adam Walsh. And yet, even with Hollywood PD apparently at a standstill, and Joe Matthews retired from Miami Beach PD, there was still desultory work on the case. In September, investigator Philip Mundy of the Broward County State Attorney's Office took the sworn statement of Bobby Lee Jones, a former cellmate of Toole's in the Duval County Jail, who claimed to have worked with Otis Toole at Reeves Roofing in 1982. In late July of that year, Jones said, Toole began to talk to him about various crimes he had committed, including the killing of a little boy. Jones recalled Toole telling him he lured the child into his car and had intended to take him home and be his father. But it had not worked out, Jones said. Toole told him he'd cut the boy's head off and tossed it into a creek, then cut up the body and burned it. Jones's statement might have had greater impact were it not for the inconsistency suggested by the dates he gave Mundy. Company records indicate that the last day of Toole's employment at Reeves Roofing was June 4, 1981, several weeks before the killing. Furthermore, he drew only one day's pay from Southeast Color Coat in December. Of course, 14 or 15 years had passed, and Jones might have been mistaken about exactly when he'd heard all this from Toole. The conversation could have taken place when they were incarcerated together in 1983. And there was no doubt that many details of Toole's confession had been recounted by the media when the case files had been opened earlier that year. Still, if Jones was being truthful, if he'd heard about it from Toole at work in December 1982, or simply as they chatted on the streets or in a bar, it would mean that Toole had begun talking to others about killing Adam Walsh long before he first admitted it to police in 1983. Meanwhile, John Walsh had decided to take matters into his own hands, even if it was a stinging blow that led him to do so. In May 1996, as he was on his way to a Washington, D.C. gathering of missing children who had been reunited with their families as a result of America's Most Wanted, Walsh received an unexpected call on his car phone. He didn't have to bother coming to New York next week to talk about next year's episodes, a spokesman explained. After 8 years, the Fox network had abruptly decided to cancel the show. He'd be kept on contract as a consultant and producer, but the decision was final. America's Most Wanted was finished. Though stunned at the news, Walsh had little choice in the matter. And after it had finally sunk in, he realized that the appropriate way to close the program was with an episode on the one case they had never featured, that of Adam Walsh. The program, which ran on September 21, 1996, was put together by John Turchin, a reporter for WSVN Channel 7, the Fox affiliate in Miami, and was based on information and tips gathered by Joe Matthews and Mark Smith, the detective with whom Matthews had worked the cold case investigation at Hollywood PD. Turchin interviewed Sears security guard Kathy Schaffer, who spoke candidly for the first time about her role in the incident back in 1981. She'd just started the job, she told Turchin, and when she realized that big trouble had indeed unfolded on that day, she was overwhelmed. While she had said otherwise, shortly after Reveille Walsh showed her the pictures of her son, she realized that Adam had in fact been in the store that day. It was also true that she had made him leave, along with all the other kids who were causing a fuss at the video game display. But she hadn't wanted to admit it. After all, if she hadn't sent him outside, he might still be alive. Turchin also brought up the fact that the cops had recovered the car that was thought to have been used to abduct Adam, but sadly it had been scrapped. And he pointed out that the cops had seized blood-stained carpeting from that car as well, also lost, unfortunately. Turchin also interviewed William Mistler, who recounted testimony that he had provided to the Hollywood police 5 years previously. He had seen a scruffy-looking man leading a little boy to a white Cadillac parked outside a Sears store on July 27, 1981. Mistler identified the boy as Adam Walsh and the man who'd kidnapped him as Otis Toole. The program concluded with some footage the Walshes had stumbled across by accident a few weeks before. 6-year-old Adam Walsh in his baseball uniform, full of life, mugging at the camera, swinging his bat, getting a hit, rounding the bases, the stuff of which heartbreak is made. Shortly after the show aired, Walsh received a call from Peter Roth, president of the Fox Entertainment Group. Hundreds of thousands of letters had been pouring in. 55 members of Congress had complained, as had 37 governors and every attorney general in the 50 states. The FBI had written as well. The network had reconsidered, Roth told Walsh. America's Most Wanted, the show that had resulted in the capture of some 400 fugitives, including 11 on the FBI's Most Wanted list, the show that had recovered 20 missing children and led to the apprehension of scores of child molesters, was going to remain on the air. Washington, D.C., September 23, 1996. John Walsh was heartened by the news from Fox, and he was proud of the way the program on Adam had turned out. How could anyone who had seen it doubt what had really happened, he thought. He and Reveille had not yet found closure in a court of law, perhaps, but this was damned close. And as for bringing Otis Toole to justice, he had plans for that as well. He'd received word from sources that Otis Toole had been diagnosed with hepatitis and AIDS by prison doctors at Lake Butler. Toole knew he was dying, Walsh was told, and it was suggested that the convict might be willing to talk to the right person. Walsh, who knew of the calamitous outcome of Mark Smith's visit to Toole the previous year, thought he had the right person for the task in the person of Joe Matthews, who had retired from Miami Beach PD in the spring and had volunteered to help Walsh on the case in any way he possibly could. And by this point, Walsh had formed a substantial network of friends in law enforcement, including the FBI and the FDLE. He was going to stop mincing around and use some of his influence to get Joe Matthews in to talk with Otis Toole once and for all. If Matthews could get a deathbed confession out of Toole, then he and Reveille could rest with that, Walsh thought. Certainly the prospect was worth using every favor he might call in. Word that America's Most Wanted would live on was not the only news that arrived in the wake of the September 21st program featuring Adam's case. A number of tips were phoned in that suggested that Walsh and Joe Matthews were right about the killer's identity. While Matthews followed up most of the leads at Walsh's request, one tip bypassed AMW entirely and went straight to the Hollywood PD. The caller's name was Mary Hagen, she told police, and though she now resided in a retirement community in upstate Florida, she had been living in Hollywood not far from the Walshes at the time of Adam's murder. She had seen things inside the Sears store that day he disappeared, she explained, and hadn't realized until she'd seen that TV segment on Adam that police still hadn't caught the killer. Perhaps what she had to tell them would help. Phil Mundy, the investigator for the Broward County State Attorney's Office, followed up with Hagen, 76 at the time. She told him that on the morning of July 27, 1981, she had noticed an ad for a lamp sale at Sears and decided to go have a look. She entered the store through the garden department entrance and passed the video game display where several kids were gathered, including Adam, whom she recognized from the neighborhood. Also standing there talking with the boys, said Hagen, was a rancid-smelling man who seemed out of place to her. He was filthy, and she could smell him, overpowering like beer and onions, from several feet away. The guy had to step out of her way so she could get past, Hagen said, and when he did, he smiled at her, a goofy-looking expression that exposed a big gap in his front teeth. She hurried on past, she said, and checked out the lamp section where she couldn't find anything she liked. There wasn't a clerk around, only one customer, an attractive younger woman who seemed to be waiting on something, so Hagen decided to leave. As she passed the video display on the way out, she noted that it was deserted. She explained to Mundy that she had thought about coming forward when she later learned what had happened to Adam, but wasn't sure what good it would do. By that time, there was all that news about people who'd seen Adam being dragged into a blue van, so what she had seen didn't seem all that important. Leave it alone, her husband Lou told her. Let the police do their job. And she assumed that is just what happened, she told Mundy, until she watched the episode of America's Most Wanted and saw the picture of Otis Toole displayed on screen. Oh my God, she thought. You mean he's still alive? They never got him? To Mundy, Hagen's story was provocative. True, she might have pieced together much of what she'd told him from various reports, but there was one thing that had never been included in any account of Toole's involvement with the crime, and that was his terrible, overpowering body odor. No one who had ever been in Toole's presence for a moment failed to mention just how bad the guy smelled, as if there was something rotting inside him, bursting to get out. Another particularly provocative call came directly to the AMW hotline from a young woman named Sarah Patterson, the individual listed as next of kin on prison records. Patterson was the recipient of Toole's few personal effects, his prison-issued Bible, some letters, and a few photographs. In years past, she'd also received a lot more from Toole, though most of it was an unwelcome legacy. As she explained to Joe Matthews, she was Otis Toole's niece, the older sister of Frieda Becky Powell, who had been murdered by Henry Lee Lucas. After her mother's death, she had been raised by her grandmother and by Otis Toole, if raising was what you could call it. Uncle Otis, as Sarah called him, favored her younger sister, treating Becky like a daughter, and Sarah more like a friend, though a curious friendship it seemed. He taught her to drink and smoke dope, and they partied hard together. By the time I was 10, I was a whore, Sarah told Matthews, and I still am a whore. Back then, Uncle Otis would turn me out to his friends for $10. He'd watch me fuck them and give them head and beat off while I was doing it. She never had sex with Otis, however, because he was as queer as anyone could be, she explained. He shaved his legs, wore stockings, panties, and a bra. He dressed in drag, got shots for boobs, Sarah said, and wore a wig. That was the way he liked to dress when he hustled other fags, she said. He could get mad, Sarah recalled, but he had a good side, too. Even if he only had enough money for one six-pack, he was always willing to share it. And when she got married at age 17, Otis came to the wedding dressed as her bridesmaid. As to the matter of Adam Walsh, Sarah had some pertinent information for Matthews. Sometime around Christmas in 1995, she heard that Otis was pretty sick and went to see him in prison. During that visit, she said, she asked him directly, Uncle Otis, are you the one that killed Adam Walsh? Yeah, he told Sarah. I killed the little boy. And I always felt kind of bad about it, too. As to why he hadn't confessed to authorities, he told her that he had talked enough about the murder of Adam Walsh, and he just didn't want to talk about it anymore. When Matthews asked Sarah if she believed it,
Sarah gave a bitter laugh. She had no doubt about it. "I know my uncle too well," she said.
The AMW segment also resulted in a call from a young South Florida man named Joel Cockerman. Cockerman explained that until he had seen the show, he did not realize it, but he was calling now to report that he had actually witnessed the kidnapping of Adam Walsh. As he later explained to Joe Matthews, Cockerman, 8 at the time, was in the Sears store and was the other boy playing asteroids with Adam Walsh when the trouble started with the kids who wanted to take the controllers away. When the security guard heard the commotion, she kicked them all out of the store, Cockerman said. Shortly after they made their way outside, Cockerman's mother came and picked up him and his sister, Mia, 9 at the time. Cockerman told his mother that he wanted to stay with his little friend until his parents came for him. In all likelihood, it is Cockerman and his mother and sister whom Bill Missler had witnessed standing on the sidewalk when he viewed the same scene from his vehicle. But his mother said it wasn't necessary for them to wait. "Look," she told Cockerman, "his dad is there now." She pointed to where a disheveled-looking man was leading Adam from the curb and into the parking lot. When they saw the photograph of Otis Toole flash on the screen during the AMW segment, Cockerman's sister clapped her hand to her mouth. "That's him," she told Cockerman. "He had more hair then, but that's him." Neither Cockerman nor his sister had reported the incident before. They simply did not realize the importance of what they had witnessed until the program aired. All of this seemed to Walsh and Matthews like fuel that might possibly reignite the investigation, until AMW producers fielded yet another call on the Monday following the segment. "Just how stupid were they?" a caller wanted to know. When asked what he was talking about, the caller passed along what no one at AMW had realized until that moment. "Otis Toole is dead and already in the ground at Rayford Prison down there in Florida." As it happened, Barry Gemelli, the Health Services Administrator at the Union Correctional Institution, had been in his office at the prison infirmary one day the previous week, completing the paperwork necessary for the transfer of patient Otis Toole to the nearby hospital unit at Lake Butler, when he got a summons from an aide. Otis Toole had taken a sudden turn for the worse. The aide thought Gemelli ought to have a look. Gemelli hurried to find Toole raving in his bed, begging God to forgive the many bad things he had done in his life. Gemelli had witnessed such scenes before. He knew there were no atheists in foxholes, and it was his experience that even the most hardened of criminals find salvation as the end approaches. But Toole caught Gemelli's attention when he began to tell God about the worst thing he'd ever done. "He had killed that little boy named Adam Walsh down in Broward County," Toole said, "and he was very, very sorry that he did it." After Toole had been stabilized and was transferred to the hospital unit, Gemelli notified the prison's investigative unit of what he heard Toole say about killing Adam Walsh, and a report of the matter was entered into prison files. Though Joe Matthews had urged Mark Smith to make his own foray to Lake Butler in the hopes of obtaining a deathbed confession, Smith never followed through. As far as deathbed confessions, what Gemelli heard that day would have to suffice. On September 15, 1996, Otis Elwood Toole, a 3 times convicted killer, died of cirrhosis of the liver at the age of 49 in Lake Butler Prison Hospital. His body was unclaimed, and 4 days later, unbeknownst to John and Reve Walsh, Joe Matthews, or anyone at America's Most Wanted, Toole was buried in a cloth-covered casket on prison grounds. John Walsh was stunned by the news. Over the years, one piece of evidence after another that might have helped link Toole to the crime had somehow disappeared, and now even the perpetrator himself was no more. Some might have theorized that Toole's death would have marked the end of the matter once and for all. The guy who did it is dead. What's left? Justice, John and Reve Walsh might have answered, and the right of any victim for the chance to know what had happened. An end to the feeling of helplessness. An end to the rage over the actions of a police force that had bungled this investigation from the beginning and now seemed intent on forgetting that the murder of Adam Walsh had ever happened.
Furthermore, the Walshes had spent 15 years dedicating their lives to the cause of victimized children and their parents everywhere. To simply throw up their hands in the pursuit of justice for their own child's death would make a mockery of everything they'd been fighting for. In this light, and though it might seem strange to say so, his own death might be the most provocative action a killer could take to elude responsibility for his crime. One can imagine Toole leering from his grave, "You'll never catch me now." And were those who had pursued him for so many years any less driven, that imagined taunt might have proven true. Even though the man himself had died, the evil that he had wrought had a way of living on. Not quite a week after Toole was buried, on September 25, 1996, an Associated Press reporter published an interview with Henry Lee Lucas, in which Lucas told the writer that he was certain that Toole was responsible for the killing. He had seen blood all over the car after Toole used it. Lucas also said that a couple of months after Adam's death, he and Toole were back in South Florida one day when Otis decided to drive him over to the Sears Mall and show him where he had picked that kid up. At that time, Lucas said, Toole took him through a step-by-step recreation of the abduction and the killing. From his cell in Texas, Lucas told a reporter that he had actually seen Adam's body in the shallow grave where Toole had buried it. "He kicked it uncovered and showed it to me," Lucas said. "I got sick about it. I said, 'Let's get the hell out of here.' I left. I never heard no more about it until 83. That interview, startling as it was, prompted no action from law enforcement despite what seemed a compelling offer from Lucas. "If they want to talk to me and take me down there, I'll show them where it's at," he said. He described the burial site as being located in an isolated area off a freeway. "We got to an old foundation in there, either a barn or a house. There was nothing there, just a foundation. There was an old oak tree or pine tree, and that's where the body was at." At the time, Hollywood spokesperson Todd DeAngelis told reporters, "None of it is news to us," but there's no mention of Lucas's claims anywhere in the case file. Furthermore, it would mark the last significant public mention of the case for a very long time. In fact, were it not for the simple axiom that the truth has a way of making itself known when someone wants to find it badly enough, the case of Adam Walsh, its files laid bare for anyone to see, the only suspect of substance to have surfaced in 15 years now dead, might have also been laid to rest forever.
Chapter 6. Thunder from Heaven.
"So you admit that you're a cannibal?"
"I have eaten some parts of them.
And the skin."
"Did you eat them raw?"
"Oh, no. You can't eat that without cooking it. Are you crazy?"
Otis Toole with Texas Rangers, March 24, 1984. Hollywood, Florida, October 1, 1996. In early 1996, following an acrimonious investigation into irregularities in the department's hiring practices, Hollywood Police Chief Richard Witt was fired by City Manager Sam Finns.
"Just say I'm leaving due to health reasons," was Witt's parting shot. "The city manager is sick of me."
Finns appointed Deputy Chief Mike Ignasiak as interim chief while a national search was conducted for a permanent replacement for Witt. On October 1st, the city hired Rick Stone, a veteran cop from Dallas who had recently retired as a chief with the Wichita, Kansas PD. Soon after Stone came on board, in early February 1997, former Chief Sam Martin died of a heart attack, and in the story that accompanied that news was a reminder of how profound the impact of one case had been. Although his 11-year tenure as chief was marked by rapid modernization and a raising of educational standards on the force, the Herald reporter noted, it was marred by a still unsolved crime that shocked and horrified the nation, the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh. Nor was Chief Stone immune from reminders that his department had failed in the matter. In September 1997, stung by charges of laziness, stupidity, and arrogance against his department made by John Walsh in his own recently published chronicle of the case, Tears of Rage, Stone told reporters, "I'd like to go back and start